Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. They're a lot like the typical college athlete. They play on varsity teams, train for hours between classes, some even earn scholarships for their efforts. They are competitive video gamers, and 50 colleges have added esports programs in just the past 3 years. But even though conferences such as the Big Ten and Pac-12 begin to embrace esports, the major organizing body for college sports, the NCAA, has yet to embrace regulation of esports. So smaller grassroots groups are racing to fill the vacuum. Zach Schoenbrunn wrote about college esports for the New York Times. We'll post a link to his article on our website at WOSU.org/all sides. Zach joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, and my pleasure for being here.
Just to be perfectly clear, esports is not athletics, right?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on what your viewpoint of athletics is. No, they're not running around playing sports as we traditionally consider sports to be. But they are organized in teams. They are generally playing in arena-style rooms conference areas, theaters. They play tournaments. Some of them have uniforms. Some have coaches, and they recruit and give scholarships. So along those lines, there's not that much that distinguishes the esports team from your football team.
When did we start to see this really take hold?
Well, the real professionalization of esports has happened recently. These varsity programs, so to speak, these are the programs, the 50 or so that you mentioned, that are starting the teams with the scholarships and the coaches. That's only been around for a few years and has really taken off in these last 2, maybe 3 years. But college esports has been around for a long time, organized on a much more club level. Really as student-run groups that gather and play video games. I mean, I think you can probably remember, college video game clubs on your college campus, maybe, going back to the 80s or 90s. A few years ago, maybe even a decade or so ago, they started to organize among different colleges, setting up tournaments and groups would get together so that they could play other schools, again, on a very grassroots, student-organized level. So that's been going on for a while. But the universities and the college administrators getting involved, that's been a much more recent phenomenon.
You mentioned the word professionalization of esports. Doesn't that automatically exclude it from the realm of the NCAA?
At the moment, yes, and that's what the NCAA is kind of trying to figure out right now, is what their role could be, because as you mentioned, professionalization does fly in the face of what the NCAA stands for, and a lot of these college teams are structured in a way that would not seem to make the NCAA too comfortable about getting involved. They allow their students to get paid to play. They, in some cases, even allow former professional esports players to come back to college and join the college esports teams. A lot of these professional esports players will burn out of the pro leagues at 21, 22, and then, they'll come back to college, and then they might play and join a college esports team. So there are a lot of questions right now about where exactly esports might fit in how the NCAA structure is currently looking. And so that's something that I know the NCAA is trying to figure out.
And the likes of the Electronic Gaming Federation, they don't care if the NCAA ever gets involved. They tell us about that and what they're shooting for.
Right. So what I found is that there are a few competing groups that are trying to organize in the absence of the NCAA, one being, as you mentioned, this Electronic Gaming Federation, which is run really by one a 25-year-old recent college graduate himself, out of a co-working space outside of Grand Central Station in New York City. And, he's just a competitive gaming fan, played in high school and in college, and he saw the need for more organization of these club teams. And so he took it upon himself to try and build his business around helping these club teams, these loosely organized, mainly student-run teams, kind of set themselves on the path to varsity status. And so that's what his role is trying to be. Obviously, you know, what it is kind of doing what the NCAA would do. And so they're also kind of waiting and seeing what the NCAA is ultimately going to decide here.
What's in it for a group that eventually does become the eSport governing body?
Well, there's a lot of money, and
which
that's
is why I can't believe the NCAA is still studying it.
Exactly, and that's why I think they're probably going to ultimately decide that it is too lucrative to pass up. You know, the popularity is really something that I underestimated as I was working on this story, and this is the first esports story that I've ever done. And when I spoke to the director of director of strategy for Twitch, which is the streaming service,
right,
that provides all the streams of the video games to a worldwide audience, when he told me that there are 10 million active users spending an average of 106 minutes per day on Twitch just watching video games being streamed from all over the world, that really perked my ears. I said, that's astounding. And I think it was number two behind Netflix in terms of engagement on a daily average. And so for the NCAA to find some way to get a piece of that potential there is, I think, important to them. And, you know, the other thing is that, you know, alongside just the money possibilities, but this is a growing popular sport among youth, you know, mainly men, but there are some women too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's, I think, what was striking to me was hearing from the students who are in these clubs, and they say, you know, we're not necessarily fans of the Ohio State football team, mm-hmm. but we still feel a part of Ohio State's campus. We want to be engaged with the campus, and we want to feel a part of something that gives us pride to be, you know, a member of the university, of the Ohio State University environment. And so an esports team is a way for them to do that. And I think the NCAA is starting to realize that, you know, there are a lot more student athletes or students that want to feel like they're engaged with their campus that are currently being left out.
But this comes at a time when it's becoming more and more controversial, this whole amateur aspect, supposedly,
right,
of college sports. I mean, they're fighting this tooth and nail, these efforts to professionalize college sports, and this kind of would be a big rub.
Yeah, it would. And what's funny is that, you know, What I sort of was hinting at in the story was that the NCAA might really miss the boat here, not just because they're kind of slow in recognizing what the potential is for esports and making decisions, which is kind of typical of the NCAA.
Exactly.
But also there is a growing sense that the schools themselves that already have these varsity teams and are already catering to the students as the students want them to be, these teams might not want the NCAA involved either.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I sensed from a lot of these schools was that they're going to kind of let the students dictate to them what they want from their overall governing leadership. And if they don't want the NCAA to get involved, then that might be the route that they decide to take. So the NCAA is kind of, it might be in a tricky spot trying to figure out, you know, whether it should get involved and whether it will be allowed to get involved.
Mm-hmm. And how that'll square, if they are, with their stand against professionalized sports.
Yeah, and that's really the big question here is, you know, how do you let a video game player earn money on his own Twitch streaming site as kind of setting up his own personal brand, which is what's happening on a lot of these Twitch sites. These fans and these Twitch users will go to a streaming site of a particular player that they like to watch, just like we would go to, you know, a LeBron James YouTube channel and watch his highlights. They'll mm-hmm. do do that for a particular video game player, but the NCAA did not allow that to happen for a college football game, a college football kicker. Mm-hmm. Recently, they declared him ineligible. So there are some real conflicts.
Well,
there.
I would imagine the conflict will arise with colleges and universities as well, though. Ohio State is very protective of its, you know, the Buckeye thing.
Yeah, and I think absolutely. What was somewhat interesting is actually there is some potential here for the universities to get involved with, if you're talking about the streaming service as well. They see it, at least from the few schools that I spoke to, they see that there might be a way to set up a Twitch streaming service that is obviously built around the esports team, but also enables classes to be streamed, lectures, concerts. And so you can almost start a hub around the streaming of, one campus activity being the esports, but also kind of branch that out into many different campus activities. And if you're getting 10,000 students who go to Twitch to watch the esports, you know, maybe there's an opportunity for them to click around and see what else is happening on campus. I think that's just one thing that the universities are trying to toy with.
Is there a video game season when it comes to college gaming?
Yes.
Is it autumnal? Is it winter? Is it what?
I think they are doing. They have I think it's like a fall. I think it's a fall and a spring. They have two different. But these are all questions that each of the individual governing bodies are trying to kind of designate as their own. Mm-hmm. EGF doesn't really, at this point, the Electronic Gaming Federation is just kind of letting the clubs handle what they want. The National Association of College Esports, which is the organizing body for the main varsity programs, they're trying to establish a more of a fall into winter season that would end with a March Madness type of tournament in the spring. So, a lot of times it also depends on when students are on campus, obviously. So all questions to be figured out down the road.
How does funding work for college esports? Some schools have, like you mentioned, full-time coaches, staff members, training arenas. They pay for scholarships. What's the funding stream for all of that?
Yeah, I mean, they're run through as they're supported by the university. Those are the varsity teams that are supporting those coaches and uniforms. Some of them are actually run out of the athletic department, as if they were, a college rowing team. Hmm. Others are run out of the student activities group or student affairs. Mm-hmm. So they're run kind of like, the geography club or mm-hmm. something like that. But obviously, they're popular and these schools are realizing that they need to devote some resources to it because, they bring back a little bit more than some of those other clubs.
Are there any universities or colleges that are resisting this that you know of that are not embracing it and maybe at their peril?
It's a good question. It depends on what you mean. It depends on the embrace. I mean, there are only right now about 45 to 50 of these varsity programs, and most of the varsity programs are smaller schools. They are mostly the schools that used to be not even NCAA affiliates, but National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics, the mm-hmm. NAIA schools. These are much smaller than your Ohio States, mm-hmm. obviously. And so they see it, the reason that they started these programs is they see it as kind of, it's their opportunity to say, we don't have a football team, but we have an esports team, so you should come to our school to join our esports team. And so I think they see it as kind of a recruiting opportunity for them.
And is it working?
It seems like it's working. Yeah, every school that I spoke to, it has been thrilled with the results of the team and the way that it has gotten attention and attracted students. So I think they're very happy with what the program has done. As far as your larger schools, their range, there's a grand, great, huge spectrum of you know, how many of these schools have club esports programs and whether or not they are taken too seriously. I mean, Ohio State has an esports program. I'm not too familiar or sure how seriously that's taken when it's compared to, you know, something like, I know Harvard and Columbia and Stony Brook in New York has a very serious club esports team. So, you know, the universities are still not fully on board yet at most of these larger schools, but I think it's, you know, I think it's going to happen soon.
Well, Zach Schoenbrunn, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
That's Zach Schoenbrunn. He is a contributing writer at the New York Times. We'll have a link to his article about esports at the college and university level on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Before the alt-right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in August, the internet was filled with popular neo-Nazi websites such as the Daily Stormer and Stormfront, and they were easy to find. Shortly after Charlottesville, which left one anti-right protester and two state troopers dead, internet service providers pushed those same hate groups off the line, forcing them into the dark web. It's been 2 months, but the question is whether the effort to banish them has made any difference. Addie Robertson wrote about it for The Verge. We'll have a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Addie joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
How did internet service providers ban white supremacist hate groups after Charlottesville? What tell us how that works.
So there's a really wide range of things that different platforms can do. So there are obviously payment providers like PayPal or Square that can stop people from taking donations or stop alt-right or sort of white nationalist-leaning crowdfunding sites from processing payments. There are individual services that are sort of only tangentially web platforms that are like Uber and Airbnb that can kick people off. And then the things that we're talking about with something like Stormfront in the Daily Stormer is domain registrars, which sell the top-level domains like .com or .org that you need to resolve a web address. So that's what happened with those two sites, is that their domain providers said, look, we're not going to give you this domain anymore. You have to go find another registrar or another top-level domain. And Stormfront managed to find another registrar, and the Daily Stormer has sort of bounced around a bunch of them.
Several of those internet providers had been hosting white supremacist sites for years before Charlottesville. Why did this become a tipping point?
It's sort of hard to say, but in a lot of ways it was that there was a very high-profile site that was mocking a very real death at an avowed white nationalist event, and it kind of was a last straw, it seems like, for, in this case, it was GoDaddy that kicked the Daily Stormer off of their domain registration. And then from there was sort of a domino effect with the Daily Stormer, and there were a bunch of other services that just decided this was a tipping point, and they didn't want to be associated with these people anymore.
When you reached out, you mentioned that you reached out to several platforms, Spotify and PayPal, and some said that they were still on the alert for white supremacist content. How are they doing that?
So as far as I have heard from them, there's a mixture of internal vetting, which is if you're a company like PayPal, you take a look at anyone who applies to use PayPal and say, okay, do they look like they're part of this ban contingent, or they rely on user flags. So as far as I know, Spotify, for example, they saw these bans brought to their attention and they kicked them off. And so it's a combination of those two for basically every platform.
Is this a sense, is there a sense that this is a momentary patrol operation, or is it something that they're going to do more long term?
Obviously, a lot of sites have said this is a long term thing, and PayPal particularly said, look, we've been doing this for a long time. Some other platforms have said the same thing, but it does seem like there was a moment at which there was a lot of public pressure, and we're not far out from it yet to, we're not far enough out from it yet to really say whether that's going to keep going, especially because if you don't have another moment like this where there's a bunch of really high profile stuff going on, it's possibly less likely that this will be brought to platforms' attention at all.
My guest is Addie Robertson. She's a senior writer for The Verge, and she recently wrote about what's happened in the 2 months since the Charlottesville, Virginia demonstration that left one anti-alt-right protester dead. If you have a question or comment for Addie Robertson, give us a call, 614-292-8513. She's written about how the internet is pushing white supremacist hate groups off the internet, but what's happening to them? Where are they going? There is a vacuum somewhere, and that happens to be the dark web, right, Addie?
In some cases, yes. In a lot of cases, it's more sort of a game of whack-a-mole.
Okay.
That there are just a billion different top-level domains and registrars you can go to. And so for the Daily Stormer, it's in particular, they just find another site, they put that site up, they get kicked off, they find another domain. They were on Iceland's top-level domain service for a while. They've just kind of bounced around because the dark web is definitely where their persistent site is, but it's not all that easy to get to, and it's really not going to offer them the same kind of wide access, like wide accessibility that a lot of other places would.
How do their followers follow them when they're bouncing around like that?
I'm sure that there are probably people who are better equipped to answer this than me, but as far as I know, there are a lot of people who are sort of following them on platforms that aren't actually hosting the Daily Stormer, but are sort of writers there, are making videos, or are posting. So there's a social network called Gab that is very popular with a lot of alt-right and sort of white nationalist people. Its premise is that it doesn't kick people off for almost anything. So a decent number of people seem to come to it from there. They post links there. YouTube, I believe, directs a decent number of people to Daily Stormer domains. And otherwise, just basically anywhere that they can post, here's a link to something that we wrote.
GoDaddy still registers Richard Spencer's altright.com, but it's banned the Daily Stormer. What's the distinction in GoDaddy's collective mind?
You'd have to ask them for the definitive answer, but the reason that they banned the Daily Stormer from what I remember is that they had very explicitly said something about Heather Heyer's death,
okay,
that they had essentially mocked it and said it was a good thing, and that Richard Spencer may still be a white nationalist, but his site did not make that specific reference.
Okay. Some argue that, well, alt-right sympathizers have argued that anti-fascist or Antifa groups that condone political violence, and there are those out there for sure, that they're not held to the same standards. What did you find?
So there are definitely anti-fascist is a little bit of a looser term than the alt-right, because generally people don't necessarily identify as I'm an anti-fascist site first, mm-hmm, or activist first, but there are sort of anarchist sites and far left sites and users that have gotten kicked off of platforms and payment processors. Absolutely. They tend to not want the same kind of mainstream publicity that a lot of folks on the so-called alt-right do. And so it doesn't necessarily matter so much if someone gets kicked off of something, because there aren't the same really high profile celebrities, and they aren't looking for the same kind of mainstream respectability. So they're more willing to just say, look, yeah, we're going to go off and take donations through Bitcoin, or sort of stay more quietly offline.
Some argue that this is a free speech issue. What are your thoughts about that?
I think that it definitely has exposed how many barriers there are to staying online, which is in some ways sort of worrying. Mm-hmm. That one of the big players here is a company called Cloudflare, which banned the Daily Stormer, and that was the only site that it's maybe ever blocked from using its services. And after that, one of the things that it provides is denial of service protection, which means that distributed denial of service attack is when someone directs a huge amount of traffic to a website and knocks it offline. And after they kicked out the Daily Stormer, it became really, really difficult for it to stay online because Cloudflare is one of a couple of companies that provides this service to this level. And so it exposed these kind of invisible barriers to something staying online that if you worry that maybe it'll get applied to something that's much more innocuous someday is a little bit worrying. I think that in terms of things like payment processing, it really is not nearly as clear that neo-Nazis need to be able to process things through PayPal.
Yeah. There, you mentioned Gab. Can you talk a little bit more about networks like Gab? They're alternative social networks, right? And crowdfunding sites with, they have different moderation and censorship policies. They're being labeled as alt tech services. Are there others besides Gab, or is that just the big player?
So Gab is probably the highest profile, quote unquote, alt tech site, and it is essentially supposed to be a substitute for Twitter or Facebook or Reddit, like a social network. Mm-hmm. It's probably the biggest of those. There are definitely lots of others. Some of them were launched much like long before the current sort of alt-right movement or alt-tech movement. Like there was an alternative Reddit launched called Vote a couple of years ago. There are also several crowdfunding sites, some of which have popped up after similar versions of themselves got banned from payment processing services. There are kind of direct copies of sites like Patreon and GoFundMe. There are more general broad site services. There are kind of quasi-political platforms. Gab has basically said that it's apolitical, that it's just quote-unquote about free speech. Other sites are much clearer about having a political platform that they're on.
Does Gab actually attract a lot of different stripes of political types?
They have definitely said that they do, and they will definitely point to people who are of different political stripes. Mm-hmm. Whenever I visit there, you really can't go very long without hitting a Hitler joke.
Okay.
So it definitely does seem to have a bent.
Does any of this make, is it making hate harder to access? Is it actually reducing its spread?
It definitely seems to have lowered the profile of the Daily Stormer just in terms of the popularity of these sites, in terms of rankings. And I think that you could argue that it is making a lot of these sites seem less respectable and that it's making it a little bit easier for platforms like Facebook and Twitter to say that they're going to crack down on individual users and sort of hate systems. So not too long after all of this, there was news that Google and Twitter and Facebook were all allowing people to target really racist or anti-Semitic terms for promoted, like promotions and advertisements. And when I spoke to some folks who work on sort of identifying hate groups, they had said, we are not sure whether these companies would have responded that quickly if something like Charlottesville hadn't, and that kind of deplatforming hadn't made it clear that this was something people wanted to happen and people took seriously.
A lot of services and sites are using other users. You mentioned they're relying on them to flag hateful posts and users and hateful content. How much of this effort to ban hate groups that way is really just people policing other people and could be misused in and of itself?
it definitely could be misused, and that's kind of one of the censorship dangers, is that if you're relying especially on these kind of knee-jerk or automatic bans, then it's really easy to weaponize groups of people to just pick anybody off.
Mm-hmm.
If there's not a person who's actively making decisions about whether or not something really violates their terms. And so it's definitely a double-edged sword.
So there are kind of two kinds of corporate players on the internet, the companies that build infrastructure through which content flows, and the companies that want to curate content and create communities. And there's a question of whether or not they should be playing by the same rules, if there are going to be rules.
Right. I mean, are you talking about sort of legal rules or norms?
I guess norms.
I think that the general consensus is that if you are a web platform, like a social network, then the norms probably should be closer to curating your community than if you are an infrastructure provider. It's sort of the difference between being able to gather on a public street versus being able to go into a restaurant. A social network is maybe a restaurant, and it's not really very worrying if they refuse to like let white supremacists hang out there and hold events. It's somewhat more worrying if you're out on the street and they're not allowed to gather there. Like, that's a very different situation.
And ultimately, going back to that free speech issue, is it ever actually free speech when we're talking about platforms that are owned by tech companies, by corporations?
I think there's a lot of disagreement about this, but I think that one thing that does tend to get lost in the discussion over white supremacists is that when we're not having that discussion, there's a lot of worry over the power that companies like Twitter and Facebook that run these walled gardens have to set the terms of how people can speak. And so I think that there's definitely not a First Amendment issue in the way that people often talk about free speech. Like, the government should not probably tell Facebook or Twitter, like, you can't ban people. But I think that it's worth having a conversation about whether it's good that Facebook and Twitter have the amount of power they do, and that if they do have that amount of power, how we want them to use it.
Okay, Addie Robertson, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Addie Robertson is senior writer for The Verge. She has written about how internet service providers are working to push hate groups offline, sometimes forcing them to the dark web. You can check out her article on the link on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. AIM, that is AOL's longtime instant messenger service, will shut down in December after a 20-year run. For those who used AIM as a gateway to the internet in the 90s, this might be a sad day. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor for Android Central, Russell Holly. Hey, Russell.
Hi.
So is this like the AOL instant messenger from You've Got Mail?
Well, it is one of the services that was underneath of that.
Okay.
The AOL instant messenger was the chat service that was eventually broken off into its own kind of separate thing that you could install. But yes, when America Online was the default way that millions of Americans connected to the internet, that chat service was kind of one of the integrated things that you would see in that left-hand panel when you first signed in.
Why was it such a big deal at the time?
Well, really, it was an integrated instant messenger service. There had been other instant messenger platforms at the time, but there were, you know, kind of the serious techie nerd people who were, you know, they already had their own chat platforms in the form of Internet Relay Chat, and so, you know, but it was a separate service that you kind of installed and configured yourself, and at the time it was a complicated process. So what made AOL Instant Messenger so appealing at the time, it was very much a one button push service. You entered in an email address and a password, and that was it. You know, all of the chat work had been done. There were chat rooms that you could go to and meet new people. You know, it was something that there was constantly just this wave of new people involved in, you know, and you could form groups with your friends. It was a lot of things that weren't necessarily new, but were now much easier for anyone to go and do.
What was your experience with it? Did you use it?
I used it a lot. It was, you know, kind of the default way to communicate with a lot of my friends in middle school and high school for a while. And then by the time college had been an option for me, I had started to move on to, you know, Google's services to distance that. So I haven't really been an AOL Instant Messenger user for, I guess, probably 12 years now, 12 or 13 years. And so it's a little difficult for me to remember what I did on a daily basis. mostly, you know, like a lot of the other chat services in my life throughout, you know, using tech, it was the thing where most of my friends were.
Well, why did they decide to shut it down now?
Really, it's just, you know, it cost more to you know, maintain for the few people that were using it than it did to leave it up. AOL Instant Messenger, you know, there was a story a couple of years ago about how many people were still paying for America Online service, you know, the dial-up service, and how it was a surprisingly large number, you know, and not really because of rural America not having, you know, spectacular internet access, but in some cases it was just, you know, large groups of people who had just never stopped paying for the service, and so it was attached to a bank account or something. And those over the last couple of years have really started to filter away. So there have been fewer and fewer people using any of the America Online services to begin with, and this just became, you know, one of the first things that was kind of obvious to let go because so few people were using it.
Well, bye bye, AOL Instant Messenger, right? So they'll just shut it down, and will people keep paying for it? Those few who have not checked their bank statement lately, or what?
It's definitely a fewer and fewer thing as time goes on, because, you know, people get new bank cards and you know, change accounts and things like that. And so it's one of those things where you get the email from AOL as a messenger saying, hey, you haven't paid this month. And you kind of go, well, of course I haven't paid this month. I haven't used that in 5 years. that's when you realize that you've been paying for it this whole time, which is a thing that happens surprisingly often with America Online. It was a lot of people who didn't realize they were still paying that, you know, $5 or $6 a month for it.
Okay. Google released a lot of new hardware last week, including two new phones, the Pixel 2 and the Pixel 2 XL. Tell us first about Google's first Pixel phones. How are they received?
Google's Pixel phones were received very well. They were considered the best camera that you could get in a phone at the time. The you know, battery on them was pretty exceptional. It had both the Pixel and Pixel XL versions had some flaws. The first being that it was not a waterproof phone, which at the time, you know, the iPhone was waterproof, the Samsung Galaxies were waterproof, and so this was you know, a pretty significant flaw to release a phone that was priced the same as those phones at the time. It was also not very easy to get a hold of. Verizon and Google both had trouble keeping them in stock, and not because they were selling so well, but just because there weren't a whole lot of them. You know, they weren't able to make them fast enough. And so, you know, it was a commercial success by Google standards. You know, it had sold well, better than, you know, the previous phones that they had worked on with other hardware partners. But it still wasn't quite at the level that they had hoped that it would get to, just because it was, you know, they ran into a supply problem.
So what about these new Pixel phones? It must have been good enough to work on and improve them, right?
Absolutely. And Google has made a whole push into hardware that is completely branded by Google. And again, you know, the focus for this phone is the camera. It is once again rated as one of the best cameras that you can get in a phone. There are two different versions, and what's really particularly interesting about this setup here is that both the smaller version of the phone and the larger version of the phone have nearly identical hardware to them. So it's not like the iPhone, where the larger version of the iPhone has a special two camera array to give you kind of depth sensing tools. This both versions of the phone are designed to have kind of the same feature set, including what's probably the weirdest thing that I'm going to see in a phone this year. There are special sensors along the sides of the phone that make it so that if you want to activate the Google Assistant, which is the Android version of Siri, you squeeze the sides of the phone, and there aren't like special buttons there or anything, but the phone can detect that you are applying pressure to both sides of the phone and use that to activate the Google Assistant instead of speaking to the phone.
Is this, you like this?
Ripping the phone hard enough. It sounds so bizarre to explain, squeeze the sides of your phone and it'll do a trick. It's really just kind of an unusual thing.
And unlike the iPhone, you're not squeezing a bunch of other stuff in the process.
Right. Yeah. This is very much, kind of gripping the sides of the phone with enough pressure. It's not something that I tried, a bunch of different times. It wasn't something that I could accidentally, trigger while it was sitting in my pocket or, while I was, sitting down with the phone or anything. You have to pretty deliberately squeeze both sides of the phone in order to wake this thing up. So it could be interesting, or it could be one of those things that, I use once or twice and then never turn back on again. I'm going to have to spend more time with the phone to be sure.
So the cameras keep getting the buzz. You keep, lauding the cameras. What can you tell us about the cameras that make sense to average people about what makes them so good?
Really, the thing that makes these cameras so good is that they're able to just work in environments that our phones have never been able to work in before. These are phones, if you're with a group of friends at a theater and you want to, grab a group selfie of people, the picture isn't going to look like weird, blurry darkness with patches of color everywhere and maybe some faces that you can make out. These are cameras that will be able to kind of pull light out of the environment so that, the picture appears brighter than what your eyes could see at the time. It's a big focus is being able to work in low light and work in what's called variable light. If you're taking a photo of someone and the sun is in the background of the photo, with a lot of smartphone cameras, the background of the photo will just be completely white because it is, overexposed, the background. And with phones like the Pixel, that ends up not being the case. The software is able to detect that information and adjust before you press the shutter button so that the photos come out, much more like you would expect from a traditional camera.
They don't have a headphone jack. Again, that's getting to be the thing. Tell us about the new Bluetooth headphones Google is introducing.
Yeah, so this is the first phone that Google has released that doesn't have a headphone jack. Last year's version had one. And to make up for that in some way, they've released these headphones called Pixel Buds. These are earbuds that have the Google Assistant software built in, and they're taking it a little further than just being able to offer, kind of music playback and being able to sync to your phone and get instructions from the Google Assistant. They actually are the first generation of earbuds that are going to start offering not real time, but very close to live voice translation from multiple languages. So you can effectively hand your phone to someone and have the Pixel Buds in your ears. And if that's, that other person is speaking Spanish or French or German, they can speak into your phone and that language will be translated into English in your ears. And when you speak back in English through the speakers of your phone to that person, their native tongue will come out from the translation of your voice.
Okay, that's crazy. If anyone is watching on TV or online, my jaw's on the floor. Really?
Yeah, it's the demonstrations that we got for it, it only works in a couple of languages so far, but it was, really impressive to see it work. And it requires a little bit of setup. You have to really be able to hand someone a phone and have them understand that this is about to happen. And this is brand new stuff, so it's going to be a little while before this is something common. But yeah, you're talking about, you know, someone speaking an entire sentence, and within a second of them finishing that sentence, the translated version of that sentence coming in through the earbuds.
That sounds like fun, if I could figure out how to set it up. How do the Pixel 2 and the Pixel 2 XL compare to other high-end phones like the new iPhone X and the Samsung Galaxy 8?
They're priced very similarly. You know, these are expensive phones. The smaller version of the phone starts at $649, which is priced within $50 of the iPhone 8. The iPhone 10 hasn't come out yet. It's not going to come out until the beginning of November. But it looks very similar to the Pixel 2 XL, where it's, you know, it's the phone that has very little on the top and bottom of the phone. If you look at the phone, it looks like it's almost entirely made of screen. And so that's going to be the biggest comparison this year is whether people are really happy with these phones that just don't have these bezels on the side, because they're very pretty, but they're also not always very durable. And so that may end up being a new kind of problem that may, you know, lead to within the next year or two kind of going back to phones that have more substantial things on the sides because they're just too easy to break.
Google will be shipping a new Google Smart Speaker with every purchase of a Pixel phone. Is this just a introductory offer? And how big of a deal is that?
This is just an introductory offer, but it is a really big deal because this is the Google Home Mini. This is the $50 answer to the Amazon Echo Dot, which has been, last Christmas was just an explosively popular item because it was, you know, cheap enough that you could give them away to multiple family members as kind of, you know, stocking stuff or gifts almost.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Google reacted very, you know, intelligently to that by having this version of this speaker that is a little louder, a little more capable. It's $50, so it's within that kind of impulse buy range for a lot of people for holidays, very much like the Google Chromecast has been over the last couple of years. And it comes in this really striking orange color that they call coral that I am weirdly in love with.
See, they just got your number. Russell, do you ever feel like they just got your number?
When it comes to, I always get kind of frustrated when it comes to a lot of technology, especially phones, because they always come out in the same, like, two colors. You know, we get this black and then we get the silver, and so there's not always a lot of color, especially in U.S. versions of technology. So yes, anytime a company is like, hey, we have this really bright, colorful version of it, then you usually have a friend in me for a little while.
What will the Google Home Mini cost on its own?
This is going to be $50 on its own that you'll be able to get starting within the next 2 weeks at Best Buy and you know, a bunch of different other places. And it works almost exactly like the existing Google Home, which is $150. But the speakers aren't quite as capable, but it has all of the same kind of basic internal functions when you go to plug it in.
Now, is this going to be something that's on your Christmas list coming up when we start doing holiday gift giving ideas?
Almost assuredly. I've been using it for a week now, and I've been very happy with the results from it.
How do the kids like it?
The kids love it. I'm not sure if it's the kind of thing that I'm ready to put in each of the bedrooms yet.
Okay.
But that's what they want. They, you know, my kids have already said, you know, we could have one of these in my room, and then I could listen to music whenever I want.
Yeah, and you're like, yeah, maybe someday.
Right.
Russell Holly, that is all the time we have. Thanks, as always, for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
It's been a pleasure.
It's Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. Thanks to everybody else for listening today to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.